Welcome to St. Louis on the Air. I'm Don Marsh. The observance of St. Louis's 250th anniversary next week is picking up momentum. A little later, we'll talk with Jim Kircher of the Nine Network about a television special he is prepared to air on Monday. It looks at the earliest days through the first-person account of August Choteau, the city's co-founder. But first, it only makes sense that one of the focal points for the anniversary commemoration would be the Missouri History Museum. It's about to raise the curtain on a year-long exhibition titled 250 in 250, focusing on a wide range of people, places, and things, from the best known to the least, associated with the city's history. Joining us from the History Museum to talk about the exhibition and some of its features are Jody Sowell, Director of the Exhibitions and Research. Gwen Moore is curator of urban landscape and community. Andrew Wonko is museum researcher. Nice to have you with us once again. It's been a couple of months since we last got together. But good to see you. We're reaching this peak time for what you're so interested in. Andrew, let me begin with you. Why is it that no one can agree on an exact founding date for the city?
Oh boy, I think you got me with this question last time too.
Right.
So on February 14th, 1764. August Choteau, or Choteau as his French name would have been pronounced, but we don't pronounce today, he landed at the site that would be St. Louis. He was an envoy for Pierre Laclede, who would become the city's founder. Choteau landed on the 14th. He began constructing buildings on the 15th. And that day's time span has become a hot-button issue for historians ever since. Was it the 14th? Was it the 15th? Who knows?
So why is he not considered the founder if he did all the heavy lifting, if you will?
Choteau was only 13 or 14 years old at the time. He was a young teenager. And it's actually kind of fun to think about what it would have been like for a 13-year-old boy to be standing on the edge of the known European world at the time, just looking off into what was a forest, now is the Gateway Arch grounds. But his mother, Madame Choteau, was Pierre Laclede's romantic interest, and the two would become a team when they founded the city.
Well, you put it so well, a romantic interest.
Yeah.
it's a complicated story that we'll talk to in a little more detail later in the program when Jim Kircher comes in, because that's the area in which he is specializing. Jody, give me a sense of the format for the exhibition that opens next week.
Sure. So we're telling the 250 years of St. Louis history through the stories of 50 people, 50 places, 50 images, 50 moments, and 50 objects. So I've been talking a lot in the last year as we've been preparing the exhibit. As soon as I tell people that category, those categories, they immediately say, well, did you include this? Did you include this? And they almost never ask it in a nice way. They always they want to find out who we left out. And we know that we can't include everyone or everything about St. Louis history in one exhibit, but we really want to showcase the richness, diversity, and complexity of the city's history by telling this wide range of stories.
You know, I'll invite the audience right now that if they want to ask that very same question, because you know, it's very hard with all that you've done, with 250 separate elements here, we're not going to be able to touch upon them all, and folks might want to call in and raise that very same question.
And people will have the chance in the exhibit to add in their own thoughts. So there's a place where people can write who they think the 51st person should be, and we'll actually create a new label every month that says, here's what our visitors are saying, who we should have included. In the places section, we have almost a 40-foot chalkboard mural of all the 50 places created by a local artist in town. But there's also going to be a section where visitors can write in or draw the place that they think should have been included. So there are plenty of chances for visitors to tell us where we got it wrong, or at least what they would have included.
Sounds like kind of a sneaky way on your part to make sure that you cover everything.
That's right. Yeah. Or of getting out of some tough arguments.
Exactly. Gwen, let me turn to you and find out what particular questions were you asking when all of this was being talked and discussed?
Well, I'll say one of the things that I wanted to be sure that got included was I wanted some mention of Mill Creek because I have a personal connection. My family grew up in Mill Creek. Mm-hmm. And usually the focus on Mill Creek is slum clearance, and it's much more than that. And I wanted to make sure that they had the whole complexity and the richness of Mill Creek, that it did start off as this very affluent, elite community, then became an immigrant community, and then became a predominantly black community. But even though it was a predominantly black community, we usually don't associate that with vibrancy, commercial activity. But that was the bedrock of St. Louis, and a lot of bedrock institutions were there. And it was really a tragedy in 1959 when that community was destroyed. There were 20,000 African-Americans living there, 5,000-some buildings. They razed every single one, except one, I think. I think one they left standing. And a lot of those were important institutions. And I think it highlights that this was more than just bricks and mortar, but it was a community. There were people there with stories, and it was a community and relationships. And I think it's almost like a cautionary tale that when you look at a community, just don't look at the physical plants there, but look at the whole entirety of the community and what makes up a community.
There's no great surprise that people don't know as much about places like that as they should.
Yeah, I think because as time goes on, especially with Mill Creek, since it no longer really exists, that it's very, very easy for it to fade from memory, and we don't want that to be forgotten.
And we talk about that a lot in the places section, because we talk about places that you pass every day. So the Gateway Arch is one of the places. Forest Park is one of the places. But we also talk about places like Gwen is mentioning, places that have been erased from the physical landscape. So one that oftentimes gets a lot of attention is the Social Evil Hospital. This was a hospital that was around when St. Louis, for a short time, legalized prostitution. But if you go to that location now, you'll see a small park, but not the building that was once there. And so there's no sort of physical reminder of, hey, what was that building? And one example that I oftentimes give is a Pruitt-Igoe. Most of your listeners probably know the story of Pruitt-Igoe, but when I teach classes, college-level classes around the city at SLU or Fontbonne, and I ask students, have they ever heard of Pruitt-Igoe? These are students who grew up in St. Louis. I will oftentimes get one or two hands raised, and that's it. So we lose these important stories when they get erased from the physical landscape.
You know, I think of Alvin Toffler's book many years ago, Future Shock, in which he made much of the fact that memories become erased as buildings and structures mm-hmm. that were once there are no longer there. That's quite disturbing.
And really, it's the same in every section. I mean, in the moment section, these are all firsthand accounts of St. Louis history. And so even some of these stories are stories that get forgotten when we don't hear about them from the people who actually experienced them. So in that section, you will hear several stories of slavery in St. Louis from a firsthand perspective. And it's a different story that you hear when you see those or listen to those firsthand accounts.
Andrew, I would have to think that for a researcher, that this must have been one fun project for someone like yourself.
Oh, it was incredible. It was a monstrous undertaking, mm-hmm. but for somebody who loves doing this kind of research and finding out these kind of stories and finding effective ways to communicate them with the public, it really was a wonderful chance.
What surprised you most in all of the things that you have? Maybe that's an unfair question, but is there something that jumps out that you basically were not prepared for?
A personal story from my own life with this. I spend every day with this kind of stuff, these stories, these objects. I wasn't expecting to be surprised by anything. And then history will sneak up on you in the funniest places, and places curators or these exhibit teams could never even guess. I'm on the exhibit team, and we have an object. It's a saloon in a bottle. It was built by a man. He took a bottle and slowly put piece after piece, little pieces of wood, and constructed a scene of a saloon inside of this bottle.
They used to do it with chips.
Right, yeah. And he would use this basically to trade for free food or beer. And the saloon this particular one comes from stood at 3200 Shenandoah. And I thought to myself, man, that address sounds really familiar. My girlfriend and I, we go to a bar at Shenandoah and Compton called Van Gogh's Martini Bar. It's the exact same building, and it's still a bar today. And this is the place I watched the Cardinals win the 2011 World Series. We went there to celebrate her first half marathon she completed. And I thought, like, this is amazing, this object. It's tied to my life in a way that nobody ever could have guessed.
And now I'm sure much more meaningful now that you know something of that history.
Absolutely.
How long ago was this happening with the construction of the bottle?
Circa 1900-ish, somewhere around there. So over 100 years.
Yeah. Wow. Well, Gwen, how about you? What jumped out and surprised you most as you were involved in all of this?
Well, that's a difficult question. I don't know if it was so much a surprise in that you start looking at things differently. I shouldn't say everybody knows Annie Malone because some people might know her, not know her. But
well, everybody knows about the parade, but nobody, but fewer know who Annie Malone was.
Well, she was a very wealthy black woman who started a cosmetics business here in St. Louis. She was internationally known, nationally known. The Annie Malone Children's Home is named after her. She was basically, I'll put it like this. In 1925, there were two wealthiest women in St. Louis was Annie Malone and a woman by the name of Mrs. John Milliken. Mrs. John Milliken inherited her money when her husband died. Annie Malone was self-made. So in an era when there were a lot of barriers to blacks and to women, this woman rose to the top. She became very wealthy and very influential. But what impressed me the most about her and what was most interesting to me about her was not just how she made her fortune, which in itself is an amazing story, but it's what she did with her money. She was very much invested in social uplift. She called herself a race woman. She wanted to uplift the race, and she set the standard for black philanthropy. For example, she gave Tuskegee, over in the 20s, she gave them a total of maybe $60,000.
Tuskegee University.
Yeah, yeah. She gave Howard Medical School $20,000. Mm-hmm. At one time, she was supporting two students in every, what we call now historically black colleges and universities mm-hmm. in the country. She was extremely generous, and she was extremely invested in not only helping elevate herself, but elevate what she called elevate the race.
And how is this story being presented in the exhibition?
Well, it's being presented in two ways. In one way, we have her as a person. She's one of the 50 people. And also, we have one of her objects, which is a little pressing oil tin. Mm-hmm. So we get to tell that story twice about Annie Malone and what she did. Not only was she an entrepreneur of unusual proportions, but the fact that she was so generous and so socially committed, I think that's what impressed me the most about her.
But as one of the 50 persons, mm-hmm. what exactly do we see aside from the artifact? When you talk about her story, is it told in any kind of detail or just a kind of very brief synopsis?
Well, one of the things, there's only so much detail we can tell.
Yeah, sure.
But we're hoping that it will even pique your interest even further, mm-hmm. to investigate further. We do kind of tease you. We can't give you everything, but we give you as much as we can in the small space that we do have. And here we get to tell that story twice, which is even more exciting.
I want to ask Jody about something that jumped out at him, but I have to take a break. But before I do that, I want to ask you, was Mrs. Milliken white or black?
She was white.
Right. So the two wealthiest women in the city of St. Louis at that time, one was black and one was white.
That's right.
All right. We have to take a break. We'll do that and come back and continue our conversation about the exhibition that opens next week at the St. Louis History Museum. It's called 250 and 250. My guests in studio are Jody Sowell, Director of Exhibitions and Research at the History Museum, Gwen Moore, from whom you just heard, Curator of Urban Landscape and Community there. Andrew Wonko is museum researcher. Back in just a moment to continue this conversation, we'd like to bring you into it. 382-8255 is our number. That's 382-TALK. You can send us an email at talk@stlpublicradio.org. If you'd like to send us a tweet, do so at STL on Air. What is it that you hope is included in this exhibition? We'd like to hear from you. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Hello again and welcome back as we continue our discussion on the special exhibition that is going to be unveiled next week at the Missouri History Museum in connection with the 250th anniversary of the founding of St. Louis. We'll continue that conversation in just a moment, but here are some of the stories our St. Louis Public Radio and the Beacon Newsroom are following today. Republican Missouri House member and budget chair Rick Stream of Kirkwood announced today that the Missouri House has rejected Democratic Governor Jay Nixon's budget proposal. Stream calls the governor's spending plan bloated and says House Republicans will instead base their proposed budget of last year's budget bills, from last year's budget bills, I should say. And the cold weather is straining Heat Up St. Louis's resources. The charity has helped more than 19,000 low-income residents with their heating bills so far this season. That's a 29% jump from last year at this time. You can hear more about these and other stories this afternoon on St. Louis Public Radio and throughout the day at stlpublicradio.org. Now back to our conversation about the 250 and 250 exhibition at the Missouri History Museum, which opens next week on the 14th, which some people think is the official founding date of the city of St. Louis. Others think it's the next day, the 15th. We've already talked about that. You can make up your own mind by going to the exhibition and seeing for yourself. My guests in studio are Gwen Moore, curator of urban landscape and community at the museum. Andrew Wanko is museum researcher, and Jody Sowell is director of exhibitions and research. Jody, back to you with regard to the things that we were talking about just prior to that break. Go ahead.
Sure. So you were asking about biggest surprises, and I don't know if it's a surprise exactly, but it's something that I've been reminded of, and it's something that Gwen alluded to before the break, which is a lot of these stories are stories that we sort of think everyone knows because we are around that history every day. But as I've gone out and spoken to groups, and even I was getting my hair cut last night and I was talking about the Great Southwest Bank Robbery to the person cutting my hair, she had no idea of this story. It's a story that we know well. The way it's displayed in our exhibit, by the way, is that's in the 50 moments section, which again is all firsthand accounts. We actually talked to the police officer who foiled that bank robbery, actually shot the robber who was carrying the bag of money out of the Southwest Bank. He's now 100 years old. His name is Mel Stein. Mm-hmm. We were lucky enough to sit down and talk to him about those experiences. His memories of that day, of course, are crystal clear. But a lot of these stories that we think about and think about St. Louis history that people know, people actually are surprised by many of them. And I think it helps to sort of make them appreciate what a fascinating city this is. And it does make them connect to the city in a different way once they know that history. So that's, I think that's the real important work, is the fact that by sharing these stories, I hope that we are connecting St. Louisans to their city in a deeper and richer way.
Wasn't that robbery the subject of an early Steve McQueen movie?
That's right. I think one of Steve McQueen's first. And Mel Stein told us that I think Steve McQueen had gotten in some trouble with the law beforehand. And so he was very nervous on set because, you might remember, St. Louis police officers were actually actors in the film recreating their role in the robbery that day. And Steve McQueen didn't like being around that many police officers. So.
He was something of a bad boy.
Yeah, I think he continued, kind of, right?
Yeah, right. Okay. How long is the interview with Mel?
So you'll just hear an excerpt of it from that. I think we sat down with him probably for about an hour that day. You'll hear an excerpt probably 2 or 3 minutes long detailing when he first got the call that there was a robbery, and talking about the fact that he was taught in the Marines to, whenever you're in a gunfight, you try to make yourself as small as possible, which really helped him because right as he ducked down and sort of got into a ball, a bullet went through the window of the Southwest Bank right above his head. So an amazing and dramatic story, but you get to hear it from the guy who lived it.
Andrew, did you play a role in this particular incident that we're just talking about in terms of researching it?
For the Southwest Bank robbery?
Yeah.
I helped a little bit on that one, but there were other ones that I helped with pretty extensively. We managed to track down the man who caught David Freese's Game 6 home run hit in the 2011 World Series, and that was quite an adventure to get him. We ended up calling about six different hospitals. He's a radiologist over in Alton. But we tracked him down, and he came in and did a wonderful interview for us.
You know, that just shows how wide-ranging the role of the researcher is. You know, it's not just sitting down and trying to determine whether it's shoot-to or show-to.
Right.
It involves tracking down someone who caught a baseball.
I feel like the really exciting thing is trying to figure out what's really going to spark people's imagination. Jody and Gwen were talking about stories that people don't know. Some of my favorites are the stories that people think they know, but they've only heard something here and there. Like, among my friends, it's got to be the caves underneath St. Louis, which is one of our 50 place selections. The second I mention those caves, everybody's interested. Oh, my grandfather used to know of a secret entrance in an alley somewhere, and everybody's got a story. But it's never firsthand. It's always my grandfather, a friend of a friend. The caves are really fascinating in that respect because they're half myth, half fact, and it makes this wonderful St. Louis legend of a place. The truth is they really were incredibly important, especially in turning St. Louis into a beer capital of the United States.
You know, I'll have to talk to you off the air. Here you are talking about the bar on one hand and about the beer on the other. Okay, Gwen, I'm going to turn to you with the same kind of question. What do you think that you found that people misunderstand, that thought they knew and maybe don't or didn't?
Well, you know, I'm going to go back to Mill Creek because there were so many important institutions there, and I don't think people really understand the vibrancy of this city, and especially Black St. Louis. I was really fascinated by People's Finance Building because it was the first commercial building built by African Americans, totally by African Americans in the United States. In 1923, there were these seven Black men. One of them was Joseph Mitchell, who was the owner of the St. Louis Argus, and there was a doctor and a lawyer, and they all got together, and they formed People's Finance Corporation. Another was George Buckner, who was the first head of the Urban League here in St. Louis. And they wanted to have a financial institution that would help Blacks, you know, buy homes, they would loan them money, because, of course, it was difficult for Blacks to get that kind of service. That was in 1923. And when that happened, according to Joseph Mitchell, might be self-serving, he said it was the first and the only financial institution built entirely by Blacks in the country, in the world, is what he said. 3 years later, they decided that they were going to start a building. It was called the People's Finance Building. And it's interesting, it's where A.G. Edwards is now, which is at Jefferson and Market. So there's still a financial institution there. But it became what was called a hub, in that every important Black institution in the city was located there, the NAACP, the St. Louis American, the Brotherhood of Sleeping Car Porters, the March on Washington movement, the Eastern Movement of the Pacific World, which was a pro-Japanese Black organization that during World War II, which was pretty dangerous at that time. But people realized that if you wanted to have a anchor in the Black community, if you wanted an entree into the Black community, it had to be through People's Finance Building. So that was a very, very important institution. And it really surprised me when I started doing the research that there were so many important institutions located in that building. There were doctors and lawyers, David Grant, Robert Witherspoon, which were important civil rights attorneys. When Thurgood Marshall came to town, Ralph Bunche, and they wound up at People's Finance Building. If somebody had dropped a bomb on that building, the movers and shakers of St. Louis probably would have been wiped out. So I think I want people to understand that there was a lot going on in St. Louis. There was a lot going on in the African-American community, and that African-Americans and in this city, even though it gets a bad rap for segregation and racism, there were some progressive movements going on here.
I think that's what the surprise might be to a lot of people who look back on the history and probably look at Black history in St. Louis is one of deprivation, poverty, Dred Scott, maybe Annie Malone, probably not, but not certainly in terms of movers and shakers who really were influential in the development of this community. David Grant, we've done two programs with his daughter.
Ah,
and,
okay.
You know, it's a fascinating, fascinating story.
Well, that's one of the things that I'm really interested in because I think we do tend to stereotype African-Americans. We focus. There's nothing wrong with entertainment and sports. That's great. But there's another side too. There were black entrepreneurs. There were people that were interested and involved in a lot of different things, and they were successful at it. And I think people need to know this.
Yeah. And do we get into the fact that many of the black entertainers who came into town couldn't stay in the hotels? And do we get into that part? There's a part of our history about which we shouldn't be very proud.
Well, getting back to Annie Malone, you know, when she built Poro College, one of the things that she had was she had living space there. And a lot of African Americans that could not stay in hotels in the city and had to stay in private homes, they could also stay at Annie Malone's Poro College. So there's so much complexity to her story that I can't get into all of it here, and we can't get into all of it just through this exhibit. But like I said, I hope it piques people's interest so they will want to delve further into these stories.
Jody Seller, do you want to weigh in on this part of the discussion? Then I want to go to the phones.
Well, I think it's important to talk about those stories that we might not be very proud of. So throughout the exhibit, you will hear stories about slavery, about segregation, about women having to fight for the vote. You hear these stories that aren't necessarily, if we were doing a celebration of St. Louis in 250 years, maybe it would be a different exhibit. But we really do want to investigate those stories as well.
Yeah, that's one of the things I found interesting in researching for this program, is the fact that you want to stay away from the word celebration.
Well, and I'm sure we use it at times, and it doesn't mean we're not proud of St. Louis. I think the people around this table and at the museum love St. Louis. But we do want to – one thing we love about it is that it is a complex city, and a city where you can tell a lot of national stories through what's happening here. Shelley versus Kramer is a perfect example. So racial covenants and – the way that that makes its way to the Supreme Court, that's only possible because of St. Louis. That's a story and a piece of our history that's important. We need to tell those stories. So that's why probably most of the time we say we're commemorating the anniversary rather than celebrating.
Andrew Wonko, did anything make you mad in your research with regard to things that you learned, saying, doggone it, that happened here?
Most of the things that we've been talking about that I already knew quite a bit about, it is sad to look back and think about those kind of mistakes. One thing I was just looking at the other day, speaking of Mill Creek Valley, in 1949, the St. Louis Civic Planning Commission put out a document that basically said how they were going to reformat the city and make a new St. Louis. And they had a map of substandard dwellings by neighborhood, and Mill Creek Valley is this giant bullseye in the middle of the map. Mm-hmm. And, of course, what happened was they ended up tearing the whole thing down. But nobody ever notices that Lafayette Square and Soulard were both also that exact same shade of bullseye red. And now those are considered assets. I mean, Soulard is our hottest neighborhood. Houses go for $500,000. And it's frustrating to see that the line between slum and asset is often just a few dedicated individuals or people who are actually allowed to speak in the case of African Americans and other minorities.
Now, of course, it's a story that's not unique to St. Louis. It's
right.
One that is from all over the country.
I just want to say something. You know, even though we have these really disturbing stories of racism and discrimination and segregation, we also have these inspiring stories about people that fought against that. Not just African-Americans, but their white counterparts as well. So we want to tell the whole story.
You know, I would like to point history at point people at this moment to something we have on our website, stlpublicradio.org, called St. Louis History in Black and White. And it's really synopses, if you will, of about 30 programs that we've done here. And what that illustrates very, very clearly is that this whole struggle did not only involve blacks, but there was a lot of white participation. Shelley versus Kramer is a case in point. There were a number of whites who were very, very active at that, as well as in the area of education. Okay, let's go to the phone. Some folks have been very patient as we've chatted, waiting to come on the air. Let's start with Jeff calling from St. Louis. Jeff, thanks for waiting. Go ahead.
Hi, thank you. You've already just touched on my second point. I hope that this year is an occasion for St. Louisans to reflect on how our early development was as a slave-holding southern city in the north, and that seems to be the foundation for a racial division that we still struggle with. My first point was I think it's unfair to describe Madame Choteau as the Cleed's romantic interest. He was, for all intents and purposes, her husband. if not by law, her actual husband abandoned her while they were in, while they lived in New Orleans, and abandoned her kids, and they never divorced her. So as Catholics, they couldn't be formally married, but they certainly lived as husband and wife.
Okay, Jeff, thank you so much for the call. Andrew, let's throw that one at you.
Yeah, Jeff's absolutely right. Laclede and Madame Chouteau did effectively live as a married couple.
But they could not get married, correct?
Yeah, the French law in the Louisiana Territory was that divorce was forbidden. And her husband, René Chouteau, was very much alive. He abandoned her, as Jeff spoke to. But Madame Chouteau used to refer to herself as widow, and even on a lot of her land ownings, she lists herself as Widow Chouteau, even though he was alive. Interesting story there.
And then I wanted to bring it back to the slavery issue, because I think we tell that story in the moment section in a really interesting and complex way. So one of the firsthand accounts you will hear is from William Brown, who said that he was an enslaved man, who said that Missouri generally had a reputation as being one of the not having a huge slave presence. And he said he wanted to correct that actually St. Louis was one of the most barbaric places in the country to be an enslaved person. A pretty gut-wrenching narrative of what slavery was like. But then we also have the story of Lucy Delaney. And Lucy Delaney spent her first 14 years of her life as a slave, but thanks to the dedicated efforts of her mother and the court system, was able to sue for freedom. What you hear in that is a firsthand account of her going before the judge and finding out what her fate was going to be and the fact that she was going to be freed. It's a pretty powerful story of a person who is incredibly resilient, spent a year in jail waiting for her verdict, becomes a free woman, works in St. Louis for the rest of her life, and actually publishes a memoir about her experiences.
Is there any one period of time in the 250 years in which the exhibition spends more time, more focus on, or how do you spread that out?
We certainly tried to go through all decades.
Sure, of course.
And that's something that we talked about very much at the beginning, because probably the easiest thing for us to do would have been to do a story just about the founding of St. Louis. Mm-hmm. But we really wanted to bring that all the way up to today. It's why you hear a story about David Freeze's home run or things that are happening in the 1950s. I think we're pretty well spread out, so you will find representations of most times in St. Louis history. Andrew and Gwen might correct me and say, oh, we fell down on this decade, or we have more on this decade. But we certainly tried to represent the full span of St. Louis history.
We do have people in the exhibit who are still alive. It's not all, history is not all about dead people. So we do have like Norman Say, Frankie Freeman, Jackie Joyner Kersee, Chuck Berry. I need to say somebody other than an African American.
Well, some people might not like this, or might
Phyllis
this. Phyllis Schlafly was what I was going to say, and actually, Phyllis Schlafly shows an example of we have a spectrum of political views. So you will learn about Kate O'Hare, one of the great leading socialists in the United States, who published right out of St. Louis, and I think the other end of the political spectrum is Phyllis Schlafly, who you will also learn about.
Well, I think that if Andrew had anything to do with it, you'd probably have Tom Schlafly is what I was thinking of. That would seem to fit the area that he has special expertise
in. He did argue for Tom Turpin quite strongly.
That's right.
Strong.
Yeah.
Let's go back to the phones and bring in Edna calling from St. Louis. Edna, thanks for being with us. Go ahead.
Thank you both so very much for the wealth of information. The issues I want to talk about, Fairground Park, which was the first site of the Mini World's Fair before it reached to Forest Park in 1904, and Fairground Park eventually became Benton's Barracks, where the first African-American troops were dispersed to go to fight the war. But in terms of talking about slavery, there were 300 freedom suits that was just found about three years ago, I am sorry. The Ville is important. Clay Morgan down in Cleese Landing is important. And And the Ville, Mr. Matthews, again, thank you again.
Thank you, Edna, for calling. Yeah, the Ville played a very, very special role, didn't it, Andrew, in our city's more modern history in particular.
Yeah, absolutely. And I'll speak to her first point about Fairgrounds Park. That's one of our 50 places, and that's an incredibly interesting selection because of the multiple histories it does have. She mentioned it was from the 1850s up until 1902. It hosted the St. Louis Exposition, which was a massive fairgrounds event where they had horse races and all kinds of other things. It became the site of the largest swimming pool in the United States, and it was a local neighborhood park. Then it became the site of a massive race riot that took place in 1949 that pretty drastically affected race relations in St. Louis.
You know, it sounds to me like people are going to wander through this this entire exhibition and say, gee, I didn't know that.
Well, and you know, research has shown us that the place where people say they're least engaged with history is the classroom. Mm-hmm. And that hurts me as someone who teaches. I assume they're not talking about my classroom. But the place where they feel most engaged is a family reunion. And that's because that's the place where they hear stories and they see sort of the real stuff of history, grandma's photograph or an old cookbook, and they do come across those surprises. I think that's what we're really trying to create in this exhibit, is a sense of, this is a great moment in time for St. Louisans to sit and pause on our shared history and to have a conversation about that history and have some surprises and learn a few new things and hear some great stories. And if we achieve that, then it'll be a success.
Let's bring in another caller. Jorge is joining us from Ladue. Jorge, thanks for being with us. You haven't called in quite a long time.
Nice to hear your voice again. Yes, concerning Steve McQueen's appearance here with the movie The Great St. Louis Bank Robbery, that occurred in 1959. There was a bar that was located west of what was Gaslight Square, would become Gaslight Square, and it was called La Jazz Hot. And it was a hot bar, and Steve wandered in there one night while they were filming in town, and came over and introduced himself to me because I was surrounded by a group of very, very attractive young ladies, and he was wanting to meet one of them. So I introduced him, and he ended up spending the night with one of them. And but during the course of that evening, he said, you have a joint? And I said, yep. He said, well, let's go out and smoke it. So we did. And it was a really fun night, and that was before he was very well known, of course. And that's my little story about Steve McQueen.
Well, if you'd like to hear another story along similar lines, read my book, Flash Frames. I've got a chapter in there about Steve McQueen and a former girlfriend of mine who became former when he stole her from right out from under my eyes.
Oh, well, Don, we're sorry to bring up bad memories, but actually that is what we want to do. That's a perfect example, is we hope that when visitors come through, they'll share those stories, oftentimes share those stories sort of cross generation. So grandfathers telling grandsons about going to Sportsman's Park or Stars Park. You know, we hope that this sparks as many conversations as it sort of informs, and certainly we're not trying to lecture at people. We're trying to get a conversation started.
Andrew, I should turn to you. In as much as Jorge mentioned a bar, is there anything you want, you want to add to that?
I think that should have been one of our 50 moments. For sure.
All right. I think we have time to take one more call. We'll bring in Kevin calling from St. Louis. Kevin, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi. Have any of your guests heard of a book called Mill Creek Valley, A Soul of St. Louis?
Yes. When did you want to expand beyond that? Yes, we have heard of it. So?
I was just wondering if they were aware of
okay.
it.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm aware of it. In fact, I had an opportunity to meet the author who wrote the book, and what I really liked about the book was that he had a lot of interviews with people that had lived in Mill Creek and grew up in Mill Creek, and they were talking about their memories of Mill Creek. And I think he did a good job in not just focusing on this was a poor community, which a lot of people do. They just focus slum clearance. This was a slum. Yeah. When I was doing research on Mill Creek and going through the Post-Dispatch, article after article after article, day in, day out, month in, month out, that was the focus, that it was a slum. And he wants you to understand that this was a community and it was not a slum.
Okay. Kevin, thanks so much for the call. I'm going to take one more. Let's bring in Susan. She's calling from Illinois. Go ahead, Susan.
Hi. I want to ask about two women from St. Louis history. One is the great Labaquere, Josephine Baker. I guess she'll be remembered. Yes, and the other one is Kate Chopin, an important early women's novelist who is routinely forgotten around here.
So both are mentioned in different ways, actually. So Josephine Baker is actually just mentioned briefly. She was actually born at the female hospital, which is what the social evil hospital became after prostitution was once again criminalized. Kate Chopin is actually not in the exhibit, but she is a big feature of our programming, and that's something we haven't had a chance to mention, but this exhibit is open for a whole year, and we have a year of programming associated with the exhibit. And one, I believe it's a theater performance, focuses on the life of Kate Chopin. So it's a great way for us to be able to tell some stories that we couldn't get in the exhibit in different ways.
There is a video component to this as well, right?
There's several great films in the exhibit. So there's one film called 250 Years and 250 Seconds, and we squeezed all that history into just 250 seconds. The 50 images are actually shown in an image theater, so it's sort of has that Ken Burns effect where they pan through the films and there's a score underneath. And then the final film is great. It's called A Portrait of St. Louis at 250 Years. You've walked through all this history, and then the final film is actually a look at St. Louis today. It's a silent film. All three of those films, by the way, there was a score created just for them by a local band called the Rats and People Motion Picture Orchestra. We had a lot of community collaboration for this exhibit, and so that's important to mention as well.
Well, let's specify once again that this all gets started on February 14th, next week, at the Missouri History Museum. Is there a charge for any of this?
No, it's absolutely free. So this is our gift to the city for its 250th birthday.
How long will it take people to wander through?
I think this is one of those exhibits you want to come back for time and again. I mean, you really could spend a whole afternoon in the moment section or watching all the films or spending time in that places section. I think it's one you want to go through and get a sense of and then come back for your favorite sections and bring others back as well.
Well, it'll be there for a year, so there's plenty
there
of time
for a year
to
and
do
it's free.
That. I want to thank you all so much for being with us. You just heard from Jody Sowell, Gwen Moore also with us, and Andrew Wonko from the Missouri History Museum. Thank you very much. Congratulations on all the hard work. I'm sure it's going to be a great exhibition.
Thanks, Don.
When we come back, Jim Kircher of the Nine Network joins us with more early St. Louis history and a program he's produced about it. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU.